I am John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. In our second episode on the Ronnie Long case, Judge, Jury, and Executioner, the team reported on the evidence collected from the Long family car during a possibly non-consensual search, the plea deal that Ronnie rejected in the face of the mandatory death penalty, and the unusual jury selection process that resulted in an all-white jury that had four members with connections to Concord Mills, where the victim's ex-husband had worked as an executive accountant. With us today are Rabia Chowdhury. She's one of the hosts of Undisclosed, the author of the New York Times bestselling Adnan story, and she's also the co-host of the 45th podcast. Welcome back to the show, Rabia.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
Also with us is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, and a law professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Hey, John, how are you?
I've been better. but what is going to cheer me up is that our next guest is Connie Walker. She's an award-winning investigative reporter and host of the CBC News podcast Missing and Murdered. The first season of Missing and Murdered won the RTDNA's Adrian Clarkson Award, and now she's back with a second season, Finding Cleo, which explores a family search for Cleo Semeganis Nicotine, a Cree woman who's sent to live in the United States 44 years ago as part of the 60s scoop and hasn't been seen since. Welcome to the show. Hello, Connie.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to say, I did not mean to binge listen to Missing and Murdered for this season, but I just got dragged into it. But now what's weird is I just get it from Apple Podcasts, and they're only up to episode 5. And my understanding is there's more episodes, which I'm very excited about now.
Oh, that's strange, because I just got a tweet, you know, probably about an hour ago saying, I was listening to 6 this morning and now it's disappeared. So I'm going to have to look into that.
This is terrible because the cliffhangers are such that you honestly would want to just punch yourself until you get the next episode. So for God's sakes, get that technical issue worked out, because there's people who need to hear the rest of it. The podcast is absolutely gripping, and thank you so much for making it. Can you tell me a little bit about, obviously we talked to you last season from your first season of Missing and Murdered, and how did you come upon this story in this particular case?
Well, I think it was really a direct result of the last podcast. You know, we did a deep dive last season on Alberta Williams and her case, and Cleo's sister, Christine, listened to that podcast and then reached out about a year and a month ago, asking if we would consider trying to help her find her sister, Cleo. And as soon as I heard her story and as soon as I heard what she told us about Cleo, I knew that I wanted to help. But I just never heard a story like this before. So I'll just back up for people who don't know about it. But Christine and Cleo and all of all 6 Semeganis kids were growing up in Saskatchewan, partly on the reserve, which was the Little Pine Cree Nation in Saskatchewan, and partly in a nearby town. And their mom, Lillian, was a single mom of 6 kids in the 70s. And she struggled, and eventually all of her children were apprehended by government social workers and child care workers. And they were taken into care of the province and made permanent wards and put up for adoption. And they all ended up being adopted into white families and kind of scattered around North America, really. And sometime after her children were taken, Lillian got word that Cleo had died, that she had been murdered while she was trying to hitchhike back home to Saskatchewan. And that is the only thing her family has known about her for 40 years. And the only real proof they even have that she ever existed is this tiny little photograph that was a school photo, it looks like, from kindergarten or grade 1. But when we start the podcast, you know, they don't know where she is. They heard maybe Arkansas. They don't know what exactly happened. Like, you know, they heard she'd been murdered, but they didn't know if anyone was charged and they don't even know her name or her birth date. Right. All of their names were changed when they were adopted, and they were children when this happened. So they don't remember, you know, her birth date. And it's been this lifelong mystery, and that they've been trying to get answers about for decades. But there are so many, as I'm sure you guys know, there are so many privacy restrictions around adoptions and adoptive families that, you know, they're not actually able to get information from government. And so we get involved and we try to help them find their sister.
I really related to it. I'm an adoptive parent and my wife is adopted and actually went through the process of finding her biological parents. But in this case, well, it's a little unclear to me as an American. You mentioned a thing called the 60s scoop several times on the show. And that, along with the residential schools phenomenon, which was something that you and I talked about the last time you were on the show, provided a much scarier context. I mean, you know, for Americans looking for their parents, obviously it's a maze to try and find their biological parents, but it's vastly more complicated because of what happened in Canada at that time. Can you go a little bit into that? I mean, we talked about residential schools, and if you could refresh us a little bit on that.
Yeah, well, they were adopted as part of this kind of wave of apprehensions that happened in Indigenous communities called what's now known as the 60s scoop, even though it kind of started in the 1960s and continued throughout the 70s and the 80s. And it was basically, you know, a wave of apprehensions of Indigenous kids into child welfare systems in the provinces in Canada. And you know, I think that for a long time, people in Canada didn't know that this was happening or didn't know very much about the 60 scoop. But now in recent years, we're really starting to hear from the people who went through it, the people who were taken from their families and adopted into white homes and basically lost their connection to their family, but also the connections to their community, their culture, their language. Like Cleo, when she would have been taken, and her older brother Johnny, they would have been Cree speakers. That would have been their first language. And then they would have been apprehended by social workers and placed in white homes. And oftentimes they lost their language. They were, you know, I think what's really important to understand, especially with these families in Saskatchewan, is, you know, this, there was a government program called the Adopt Indian and Métis program, in which the Semeganis kids were adopted into or through. And it was a program that was essentially a PR campaign. Like, they had all of these Indigenous kids that they had apprehended, and they felt like they needed to find them permanent homes. But they were cognizant that there was so much discrimination and prejudice against Indigenous children that they created this PR campaign. And they had commercials, and they had radio commercials and television commercials that kind of showed all of these Indian and Métis kids just doing regular kid things. And they had advertisements that ran in the newspaper every week with, like, you know, a picture of a child who had been dressed up and had their hair done, and a little blurb about them. And, you know, one of the women that we talked to, who was a vocal opponent to the program in the 70s, said it was like, it looked like they were adopting a pet. Adopting a pet instead of adopting a child. And so it had, you know, devastating impacts for the children. It often had devastating impacts for the children who went through it, including all of Cleo's family, obviously Cleo and all of her family. And I think that, you know, what we try to get into in the podcast is, you know, this mystery to help them find out the truth about what happened to their sister and where she was, and, you know, solving that. But really, we're also trying to help people understand the true history of what happened in Canada and how Indigenous people have the realities of life that we currently live in and what's informed that. You know, the history of residential schools, which was this forced assimilation where hundreds of thousands of Indigenous kids over generations were forced to go to these boarding schools where they weren't allowed to speak their language. They were punished for practicing their culture. It's really, you know, we're also, again, just learning about the devastating impacts that that is continuing to have in Indigenous communities. So, you know, this is, quote unquote, a true crime podcast, but it really is, I think, in the same way you guys are, also trying to touch upon, you know, the bigger issues that impact marginalized people who interact with institutions and governments.
I bet you might not even know how many different things you can do with a website. And at this point in time, I feel like everybody needs to have a website for something in their life. You can turn your cool idea into a new site, showcase your work, a blog, publish content, sell products. You can even, like, set up a site just to announce a new event coming up, you know, or something special, a special occasion coming up, and promote an actual business that already exists. Having said that, setting up a site on your own can sometimes seem daunting, and it costs a pretty penny to get someone else to create your website. Well, that's where Squarespace comes in, because Squarespace does all of the work by giving you beautiful templates that are created by world-class designers. They have really powerful e-commerce functionality. It lets you sell anything online, and you can customize the look, the feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for mobile as well, right out of the box. It is so easy to create a gorgeous website all by yourself and make it stand out. Look, Destiny is calling. It says you need a new website, and you can make it with Squarespace. People in every industry imaginable use Squarespace for every kind of use imaginable. Yes, including lawyers, investigators, people working on wrongful convictions like us. In fact, we end up finding many of our wrongful conviction cases on websites set up by people, by loved ones of folks who are wrongly incarcerated. So Squarespace is great even for people who have a cause they want to promote. And right now, if you head over to squarespace.com, you can actually get a free trial. And when you are ready to check out and actually purchase the website or even a domain name, if you use the offer code undisclosed, you will get 10% off of that first purchase. Once again, go to squarespace.com to create your own website for free, try out their free trial, and then right before you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to get 10% off your website or domain name. If you can think it, you can dream it, well, you can make it with Squarespace. Connie, one of the most shocking things to me about listening to the series is that these adoptions were not just done in Canada. They were, I mean, children were adopted to the United States. Why did that happen? How did that happen? And how common was that? I mean, or is this just kind of, like you said, you hadn't heard a story like this. Is this kind of unusual that this happened?
Yeah, well, what happened was that they didn't have enough homes in Saskatchewan. They weren't able to adopt. They didn't have either enough homes or children who were considered harder to adopt or harder to place were then actually registered in this program called ARENA. And I should know what the acronym stands for, but it's basically like a registry of adoption agencies in the United States, so that two of, like, Cleo and her brother Johnny ended up being adopted into homes in the United States through this program called ARENA. And I think that, you know, what it was that they had all of these Indigenous kids in care in Saskatchewan. They felt that finding a permanent home for them was the most important thing, regardless of whether it was in a white family or not, and that it made financial sense for them to adopt these children out rather than pay for them to be in foster care. And the kids who did stay in foster care, they said, had terrible outcomes. So there was this program where a lot of kids, and you know, we don't actually know how many, ended up being adopted through this ARENA program and registered through these adoption agencies in the States and adopted into the United States. And what's so interesting about that is that Johnny was adopted into Pennsylvania in 1975. And when we were looking through the archives in Saskatchewan, we found a memo that it was actually a week after his adoption was finalized into the United States, the Saskatchewan government stopped sending kids to the United States. They said they didn't want to be seen as exporting Native children to solve their Native problem. And it's, And, you know, there's actually a really great More Perfect episode that goes into a similar thing that was happening in the United States to on reservations in tribal communities about the large scale apprehension of kids and the adopting out into white families. And it led to this act that actually prohibits Indigenous kids from being adopted into white families. Although I think that there was, they talk about a current case, but it was a really good More Perfect. I felt there were so many parallels.
It's fascinating to me that these programs that are ostensibly and can be rationalized as programs to help people, as almost charitable acts, actually have these incredibly devastating ramifications. I don't know to what degree people understood that they were. Do you feel at the time people understood that they were destroying the culture or?
No. And we found, I mean, they knew there was a backlash. They knew there was opposition from Indigenous groups, and they respond like they were writing back and forth to each other about it. How should we handle it? And, you know, they did. they were able to get some slight changes made. Like they changed the name of the program. It, instead of being called Adopt Indian and Métis, it became AIM Center, but it still was largely focused on Indigenous kids. And then we found memos where, you know, they pretty much dismissed the idea that there was a culture even in need of protecting, you know? I mean, there was, I think that really what the podcast is trying to get at, and what I learned in doing the podcast was that it's not a black and white issue, that there are so many shades of gray. And we tried to contact several people who were involved in this AIM program in Saskatchewan, and it was really hard to get someone to come on and talk on the record, you know, because it's become so controversial, and because, you know, we're hearing more about how devastating it was for kids. But we did end up speaking with the man who was the director of child welfare at the time when the program started. And he didn't say he regrets the program. He said he has mixed feelings about it. And we did speak to two other people on the record, who one was a social worker at the time and the other was involved in the AIM program. And they also didn't express regret. And I think that what they said was that they wouldn't want to be judged, you know, by the practices of today, what they were doing in the 1960s, that things have changed so much and that they were operating with, you know, the best knowledge they had at the time, but that they were encountering children who were in sometimes life and death situations and that there needed to be an intervention. But one of the things that I think colors this case, but also if we're talking about justice that Indigenous people face in Canada, and I'm sure other marginalized groups face, is the attitudes, right? That they, all of the social workers who were doing these apprehensions were all kind of white middle class people, and they preferred that outlook. And so the Indigenous culture, which relied more on extended family, which, you know, had different models for child rearing and care, were seen as, you know, sometimes being neglectful, or, you know, there was just a different frame of mind that was judging these situations. And, you know, it is, I think, you know, really, really kind of telling that these social workers that we were able to talk to, they don't say that they really hit, a lot of them took issue with the term scoop, 60 scoop. They felt like, they said this, you know, it wasn't like we're out for a Sunday drive picking up kids. They wanted to try to really make the point that they were dealing with sometimes really devastating situations. And they talked a lot about how so many families that they encountered when they were apprehending kids were residential school survivors. So people who themselves had been apprehended as children and sent to these residential schools and who grew up in abusive situations in these institutions, you know, it's not surprising that then, you know, when they're having children, that, you know, they're dealing with the issues that and the trauma that they experienced when they were kids. I do want to tell you guys about one memo that we found in the archives, though, was from a social worker to the director of the AIM program. Kind of, you know, she was going to be getting something called the Salesperson of the Year Award because she had so many court dates coming up and was going to be getting a whole whack of kids being made permanent wards. And she was, you know, in a joking way in the memo, joking about the, you know, we've got brown-eyed ones, we've got blue-eyed ones, we've got brown hair, blonde hair, we're going to have the greatest, you know, this great section of cross-section of kids that we'll be able to place for adoption. And I think that, you know, that there was a joke, but I think it's really telling in some ways about the attitudes that were prevailing at the time.
It's terrible.
Yeah. You keep using the word apprehended. And for me, that's always, you know, we apprehend criminals here in the United States. Yeah. But obviously these children, this wasn't because the children were doing anything wrong. It was because the parents were going through substance abuse problems, or the government had decided that the parents were being neglectful for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and there are other, I mean, there, yeah, you know, this is the one instance in this case, but there are other people who, you know, firmly believe that they were unjustly, like that they should never have been apprehended, and that this is the issue with Cleo and this Magnus family, is that they were also partly living with their grandmother and growing up with their grandmother. And their cousin Wayne, who's now chief of his community, who still speaks his language, who is so connected to his culture and is so, you know, protective of that, he actually witnessed an apprehension of his cousins. They were all living with their grandmother and they were staying with their grandmother. And he said there was a knock at the door and these men came in and they took Lillian's kids and they put them in the back of a car and then they drove away. He made the really interesting point. If this home somehow was unsafe for children, he said, why weren't we taken? Like, they only took Lillian's kids. They didn't take our kids. Like, you know, if it was, you know, because he was growing up there with his siblings as well. And so he asks the question, why couldn't they have stayed with our grandmother? We were all living with we were living with our grandmother. Why couldn't they have stayed? And some of these questions we just might not ever get an answer to, which is, you know, it happened 40 years ago. I think the other point in the podcast that we really try to make is that there are still so many parallels between what happened 40 years ago to this one family and what is continuing in Canada today.
You mentioned actually that the government has made some sort of a stab at a settlement with the people who went through this.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a number of lawsuits by 60 Scoop survivors launched against the federal government because, you know, so many of them had experienced obviously trauma, but also, you know, they felt that the government didn't do enough to help protect their language and culture. And they won the court case last year, and the government has proposed this $800 million settlement that was announced last October with 60 Scoop adoptees. It's $750 million for individual compensation, so for individual adoptees, and then $50 million for some kind of foundation that's dedicated to reconciliation. And it's for all First Nations and Inuit who were removed from their homes and lost their cultural identities as a result between 1951 and 1991. But if you remember, I said a program that was in Saskatchewan was called Adopt Indian and Métis. And Métis are another kind of an Indigenous group here in Canada. And this settlement excludes Métis people, which has been really contentious in Canada. And, you know, we've been hearing actually recently that there's been a campaign from some 60 Scoop survivors to reject the settlement, that they felt like it actually didn't go far enough. And so, you know, it remains to be seen what's going to happen. They're still waiting to hear more of the details of the settlement. And you know, the people who believe they're entitled are registering with the government and will soon, or I don't know what soon means, but will eventually hear what their individual compensation will be.
So I wanted to get to the undisclosed case that we've been talking about.
I listened to the first episode.
It doesn't get better for Ronnie, sadly. But what we talk about in the second episode is how his particular trial started. What we discussed in the first episode is we talk about some of the crime. And then in the second episode, we got into the composition of the jury that convicted him and how the process through which he ended up in an all-white jury. And my understanding is there's a lot of sort of overlap in terms of issues with Indigenous people in Canada as well, in terms of their representation on juries. Is that the case?
Yeah. It's been well long documented, this issue of the underrepresentation of Indigenous people in juries across the country. There's a Justice Frank Iacobucci here in Ontario delivered a report in 2013 where he found that it was particularly an acute problem in Northern Ontario, where Indigenous people make up 36% of the population in some areas, but less than 10% on the jury membership. And he had, you know, a series of recommendations aimed at kind of improving, you know, the way that Indigenous people are contacted and if they receive any kind of compensation that would allow for, you know, kind of a broader participation. But it's become this report from Frank Iacobucci, I think, was in 2013, but it's become a very big issue again this year after an all-white jury acquitted a white man in Saskatchewan named Gerald Stanley So Gerald Stanley was acquitted of second-degree murder in the Colton Bushy case. Colton Bushy was 22 when he was shot and killed on Stanley's rural property in Bigger, Saskatchewan in 2016. And, you know, the trial was only a few weeks long, and it was, you know, front-page news here in Canada throughout. And one of the things that first made headlines was the fact that Gerald Stanley's lawyer used these peremptory challenges to dismiss all of the Indigenous members of the jury pool. So it ended up being an all-white jury that acquitted Gerald Stanley. And that, you know, that case, after the acquittal was, the verdict was read, there were protests across the country. And, you know, the Justice Minister in Canada, Jody Wilson-Raybould, said that the underrepresentation of Indigenous juries needs to be carefully studied and considered. And so it's a hugely relevant issue here in Canada as well when it comes to Indigenous representation.
Well, in the United States, you know, we have the concept of, you know, it's supposed to be a jury of your peers. But obviously in the Ronnie Young case, that is not what occurred. But what I was wondering is, where does the concept of a jury of one's peers actually come from? I would imagine, Colin, you've got some insight into that.
Yeah, that goes back to 1215. So that was the Magna Carta, this old document that has a lot of the legal rights that eventually find their way into the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And what that said is that there couldn't be a judgment against a person unless it was a lawful judgment of his equals or by the law of the land. And what that meant was they had sort of a class system there in England at the time, and you couldn't have members of a lower class deciding the guilt of someone of a higher class. And, you know, even though it says a judgment of your equals, women were not represented on juries. And there's a lot of scholarship about women being convicted in England in the 13th, 14th century by all male juries. And then United States, of course, we have this Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury, which is a jury of your peers. But African-Americans and women were not allowed on juries. You might think the Equal Protection Clause that came after the Civil War would have provided it, but no, that didn't. It wasn't until years later that African-Americans could even be on juries. It was then decades later, at the same time as the voting rights movement, that women were given the right to serve on a jury. And even now, I think the most recent report, this was by Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative. They studied 8 southern states and found that 80% of African-American jurors, this was in 2010, were struck through peremptory challenges, those challenges that are discretionary. And so, I mean, it continues until today, where there's chronic underrepresentation of African-Americans on juries. In some counties, 80% of trials, there's not a single African-American on the jury, despite, you know, a pretty significant percentage of the population in southeastern states being African-American.
That was similar to the Colton Bushy case, because it happened in northern Saskatchewan. And typically, the further north that you go in a lot of the provinces in Canada, you know, the representation or the percentage of the population becomes more Indigenous. And so I think that there was, you know, actually efforts made to make the area in which they selected the jury, you know, it was huge. And it included some areas which were the majority of the population was Indigenous. But then I don't know if this is an issue in the United States as well, but, you know, that then becomes an issue of the challenge of transportation and getting people to the jury, the issue of compensation and how practical or like what are the logistics of getting Indigenous people to be actually to have the capacity or to be able to sit on a jury for an extended period of time. And those are some things that, you know, I'm not sure if there are issues in the States as well, but certainly specifically in Canada, when you're talking about the Indigenous population, that's something that needs to be considered.
Yeah, very much. There was a report out of Detroit a few years ago, and that was looking at chronic underrepresentation of African-Americans on juries there. And it's, Connie, a lot of the reasons you mentioned where, you know, first of all, how jury roles are selected, it's often based upon property records and voting records, and there are reasons why that leads to minority underrepresentation. And then people who are responsive and show up even before we get to jurors being struck, there are economic issues, the low pay that we have for jurors, and systemic issues that even before we get to jury selection, you have underrepresentation of minorities in these veneers or the jury roles in the case.
Yeah, it always amazes me when I've served that anybody can do that economically. You know, yeah. I can do it economically because I actors get huge periods of unemployment. Honestly, they should populate most juries with actors because we have the free time. But virtually everybody else on the panel with me, I was astonished that they could get away from their jobs or get away from their responsibilities of their families long enough to do the gig. It's amazing to me.
You mentioned about using voter rolls to select the jury pool, right? And there was actually the person who ran was the head commissioner, chief commissioner of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, which was the commission that traveled across the country to record the testimony from residential school survivors about their experience. He is a former judge from Manitoba here, and he actually studied this underrepresentation of juries and found that, you know, it was 1952, until 1952 in Manitoba, Indigenous people were not allowed to vote. And so therefore, obviously, they didn't appear on the voters lists from which the juries were drawn. And that even two decades after that, that you know, the majority of people who live on reserves were not necessarily included in the jury rolls, that it was just in 1983 that in Manitoba, and I think they do it in Saskatchewan as well, that they switched to health registration information to try to, you know, be more representative. But it seems like it's been a widespread issue that has been documented for a really long time. And like so many things, it's maybe surprising or not surprising that it's still an issue today.
And in Ronnie Long's particular case, it was an all-white jury, which, you know, I'm a white person. I like to think I'm fair. but, you know, culturally, I have biases and I have, you know, I was raised within a certain culture, you know, so there's always going to be some judgments that juries have to make that they're going to do based on their culture. You know, they're not supposed to specifically, you know, not do that. But in the United States, obviously, we've had, you know, such serious problems with racism for so long. You know, and when we go back through the years, so many of our most famous cases were decided by all white juries. You know, it was just something that was normalized for us. But the problem becomes, how do you address it, you know, without imposing a new sort of racial quota?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I mean, I don't know. Is that the actual answer here? I mean, for me, it's like, you know, it's interesting. Over the last few years, I've done a lot of like just like independent research on like bias and how it operates in the law. And, you know, I read that scientists have identified like literally 170 different cognitive biases that we all like carry without knowing it. And I guess that's the whole purpose of the process of, you know, jury selection. But, you know, in this particular case, the fact that a number of the jurors were like directly connected to the plaintiff or potentially connected to, the, you know, to this company, I'm wondering, like, how does that get past a defense attorney? Like, you know, doesn't that rise to the level of being able to like exclude a juror based on that obvious conflict of interest?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely in a typical case, you would exclude. And I think what happened here looking through jury selection is just there were so many people connected to Cannon Mills that you could only strike so many jurors. And that's the issue we addressed in the podcast of, well, why didn't they move to transfer venue? In most cases, you would. This was essentially a company town, I think a lot of people would say. And the problem was the place they would transfer it to was known to have heavy Ku Klux Klan activity. And so, of course, having a case of an African-American man accused of raping a Caucasian woman in an area where there's Klan activity is probably not the best idea. And I think that's the reason why there were just so many prospective jurors who are connected to Cannon Mills that they could only strike so many and you were still left with four.
But why was that the only alternative change of venue? There wasn't another county in which it could have been moved? I mean, there's only...
Yeah, I guess you'd have to sort of look back to this. I mean, now certainly you can move to a farther away jurisdiction. I don't know in the mid-70s whether that was an option.
Okay.
If it were, absolutely, you want to move to a county that is not racially prejudiced and doesn't have the connections. But yeah, I just don't know if that was an option in this case.
Okay.
If you're a fan of true crime, I have a new podcast for you to check out called Case File. Every Saturday, Case File extensively researches a new topic and through their unique storytelling ability keeps listeners on the edge of their seats until the end of each episode. From the shocking to the terrifying, from the strange to the unexplained, Case File covers every topic, educating and entertaining the listener the whole way through. Their most recent series covers Silk Road, the infamous marketplace of the dark web, where for a price, anything could be bought, including people and murder. From Rolling Stone magazine to the popular website Mashable, Case File has been a constant on best of lists all over the world. You can search and subscribe to Case File today on Apple Podcasts wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
So now, does this become an issue that they could seek redress from in terms of Ronnie's defense, or has that already been tried?
Yeah, that's already been attempted. Anything having to do with the jury selection process, anything having to do with the jury strikes. Now, what could happen is, and we just actually, if you look today on Twitter, old friend Claire Gilbert from the Georgia Innocence Project, there's a case of an African-American man in Georgia in 1977 who was convicted by an all-white jury. And they got from the district attorney the strikes of the jurors. And next to the Caucasian jurors, there's the letter W. Next to the black jurors, there's the letter N. And all the black jurors are stricken. And so, yeah, I mean, they're moving for a new trial now. What they're saying in the Ronnie Long case is what the sheriff did with the undesirables that he crossed off, that document's missing. If at some point in time that document surfaces, that could lead to an appeal. But barring that, that avenue for relief is gone.
What are the odds that that document could resurface?
I would have to think that they shredded that. I don't think it's something where it went missing. I think intentionally they got rid of it and didn't want discovery. But you never know. As we'll see in the final episode of this series, there's new evidence in this case that continues to surface that's gone missing for decades. So you never know.
But I have never heard of a sheriff going over the jury rolls. I mean, you mentioned there was one other case, but, you know, I've never heard that anywhere else in the United States. It seems like it's so anomalous. And was that sheriff ever asked to testify or give any kind of reason for why they did that?
It was North Carolina law at the time, and they were allowed to do that. It's been changed since, but yeah, I mean, it's a very strange procedure. And as I said in the episode, I'd never heard of any other state having it. It seems like a terrible idea, especially when you're giving them discretion to strike these so-called undesirables. But that was the law on the land at the time.
Oh, but wait, was it that they were allowed to do it, or that was just an expected part of the process?
Yeah, well, I think in Concord it was expected. I'm not sure about other parts of North Carolina whether it was normal, but yeah, certainly in this case it didn't appear to be out of the ordinary.
So, got it. So it was something that the sheriff would supposedly do for many other cases. This isn't just something that happened to Ronnie Long.
Right. When the jury commissioner was testifying during the jury selection process, he said this was typically done. Sometimes it was the sheriff, and then sometimes it was either the sheriff for the chief of police in cases in Concord. They would get that list, they would cross off the people unqualified to serve, and then in their discretion, based on people they knew in Concord, they could cross through people they considered to be undesirable.
Well, and I mean, but that is illegal now, right? You cannot, in
Correct.
The United States, reject a potential juror on the basis of race, right?
Correct. Yeah. So and there was some precedent before 1976, but really it's this Batson versus Kentucky case, which I think is a 1987 case. That's the big one that set forth the equal protection standard and said you cannot engage in the discriminatory use of these peremptory strikes. And if you can, it's grounds for a new trial.
One of the big issues that we were talking about in the Ronnie Long case was the issue of cross-racial identifications. My understanding is that that's also an issue in Canada amongst Indigenous people as well.
Yeah, I mean, there was a law professor named Miles McClellan who said this is a huge issue for Indigenous people who are accused of crimes in Canada. And in particular, Aboriginal people can be vulnerable. And I'm sure there have to be similarities in terms of they identified seven systemic causes of, you know, wrongful conviction, which includes eyewitness identification, false confessions, tunnel vision, misconduct by the Crown. But that, he, you know, along with those seven systemic causes, he thought that they should add non-representative juries to that as well. But, you know, I think that what you were saying earlier about cultural bias, I feel like that has to also be applicable to eyewitness testimony and eyewitness identification as well. Your research on that, Rabia, has that shed any light on how cultural bias affects that?
Well, I'm pretty sure that there is. I haven't read particularly research myself, but I do know that there are statistics where, you know, I mean, like especially cross-racial identifications are really problematic. I mean, there is something to be said, this is going to sound horrible, but when people make kind of crass judgments about an entire other ethnic group of people saying they all look alike to me. But there is something there. And I think it's almost like a biological, physiological thing where people do have much more trouble identifying specific identifying features of people who are from another ethnicity. And I don't know, I know it exists in my ethnic group. I know it exists in other ethnic groups. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, who have thought I'm somebody else, and it's so clear that I'm not that other person, but I think it's the same kind of thing. So I think definitely in witness identification, it makes a difference. In terms of, you know, eyewitness testimony, yeah, I mean, if that testimony is for the purpose of identifying, then certainly if it's for the purpose of other things, I mean, obviously there's witness testimony that can be, I mean, not about that necessarily, but yeah, I mean, cross-racial identification is a problem, but then I don't know exactly how you account for that. I mean, if you have somebody who's a witness to a crime, how do you discount the fact that this person might not be able to make a correct identification? Unless you're able to show, for example, that during a lineup or a photo array, you know, that they had some confusion or they were not able to identify. So if there's some kind of a test that could be run, like, are they able to identify somebody else? I don't know exactly how to account for that particular. I think in juries, it might be a little easier to do because you can strike jurors. But how do you do that with a witness other than try to impeach their credibility somehow?
Colin, is there any way for the idea of the fallibility of cross-racial identification to be introduced into trials? Is there any appropriate means of doing that?
Yeah, this is a highly contentious issue now. There are two options out there, and some courts have approved them. Other courts have said we're not going to allow it. So the two options are, one, some courts allow expert testimony, and so you'd have an expert just like the one we had in the first episode coming in and explaining to the jury, this is a case of a cross-racial identification. Here is the research that shows these are inherently more fallible than identifications of someone who is the same race as the eyewitness. And the second is, some jurisdictions have approved a jury instruction where it's the judge instructing the jurors. Look, there's this body of research and it says that cross-racial identifications are less reliable, and here are the statistics, and take this into account when you are judging the case. Other jurisdictions say, no, this is something where we're not going to allow expert testimony. We're not going to allow an instruction. This is still an eyewitness identification. The research isn't strong enough, and we're just going to allow the jurors to hear the testimony, make their own judgments of credibility. And so, yeah, this is something really every few months we see a new opinion, and it's pretty equally divided as to courts allowing this versus not allowing it.
And it's an idea that has not permeated pop culture at all. I mean, honestly, I had never heard of it until I did this show. And not everybody can, we can't have entire jury pools hosting their criminal justice shows in an effort to educate Americans. But it is interesting to me that it's something that seems to exert a pretty powerful force on eyewitness testimony is something that is barely mentioned.
I wonder how, I mean, because we've recently just undergone cultural bias training here as journalists at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. But I wonder about how or if it's taught in law schools in the United States. Canada? No.
I teach it in my class. Jennifer Thompson. Yeah, Jennifer Thompson and the Ronald Cotton case that we featured on the first episode. There's a 60 Minutes segment, and I think it's Leslie Stahl is actually taken through a video where she sees a crime and then is asked to make a cross-racial identification from a photo array and identifies the wrong person and is very confident in her incorrect identification. So I use that in my classes to show cross-racial identification. But yeah, a lot of classes won't get into that.
And the other thing is, I mean, like, you know, there's a certain my generation of attorneys, a lot of these issues have not been really identified and understood until maybe the last 10, 15 years. And even though, you know, Colin, you said the courts are split, at least, I mean, it's an encouraging trend that I feel like it's new enough that maybe over the course of the next 10, 15 years, it might become ubiquitous, but we're moving in the right direction there. So these are not even issues. When I was in law school, these issues were, I mean, like, we didn't even... The research, I don't know if the research existed, but I wasn't aware of this, and certainly it wasn't taught in my law school. And many of the lawyers who are my contemporaries also were not taught these things.
But were you aware of it anecdotally as a racialized person that these kinds of things? Because, I mean, the thing with the 60 Scoop and the Cleo story is that, you know, we're hearing from a lot of First Nations and Indigenous people who have a personal connection either to the 60 Scoop or to child welfare themselves or to residential schools, where, you know, it's almost the opposite reaction of all of the non-Indigenous people who listen, who are learning this for the first time. And so it's like, you know, for a huge segment of the population here in Canada, this seems like it's an education to learn about the 60 Scoop. And there, but for the section of Indigenous people, this is something that they've been dealing with their entire lives, whether it was, you know, interactions with child welfare or just the legacies of residential school, even if it wasn't necessarily named or acknowledged or identified in classrooms or institutions in the same.
Yeah. You know, I think it depends on, you know, who you're asking that question to. Like you said, I mean, if you ask a Black American, you know, who can come to this issue with history of all this, they would probably say absolutely, yeah, they recognize this anecdotally, whether or not it was like an academic study. But for South Asian communities, it's relatively new. For, like, say, Arab communities, other kinds of communities. Like, our interaction with the justice system has not been as... We don't have as long of a history of it. We also don't have, I mean, now we're in a place where maybe you have more and more like South Asian and Muslim attorneys, more people going to law school. I'm telling you, when I went to law school, I literally did not know a single other South Asian Muslim in law school at that time, 20 odd years ago. So the awareness will increase as our interaction with the system increases. And, but generally speaking, I mean, outside of the system, obviously, like I said, you know, we joke of so-and-so, everybody looks the same in this community or that community. But with how that operates in the legal system is something that we're really starting to get an understanding of now.
I wonder about, like, just in terms, if you're talking about representation, you know, and the progress that's been made, how much of that is due to just the amount of voices that we have access to now that we're so focused on digital storytelling, like podcasting, or that's something that I'm really curious about in general. That's not necessarily related to this, but
I'm curious too. I think that people can dip their toe into a massive hive mind at the drop of a hat. It has to be having some effect. It is fascinating to me to interact with people, and you know, what is remarkable is that even having access to that, there's still people so resolutely dedicated to being dumbass. You know, it's like, wow, you just run into people who are just like, wow, just read a book, something. You have the world at your fingertips, read it, you know. But I'm sorry, that's just my own point. One thing that struck me about the episode, the Ronnie Long case episode, was that he had a terrifying choice to make at one point. He was offered a plea deal for 7 years, you know, which is, you know, obviously scary. But on the other end is a mandatory death sentence if he doesn't take the plea. You know, he unfortunately was dealing with it during a time when that happened to be the law. Does Canada still have the death penalty?
No. I think it was abolished in 1976, but the last execution was long before that, in 1972, or 1962, rather. And I think that, you know, outside of that, I think that just Canada's actively opposed to it, and refusing to extradite requests to the United States unless there are assurances by U.S. prosecutors that they won't seek the death penalty.
Is that in every province it's been abolished?
Yeah. Canada, it's across the country.
Yes, in the United States, it's, you know, an incredibly thorny cultural issue. You know, very often people who states where they feel that crime is particularly threatening feel that the punishment must be particularly threatening as well, in order as some sort of a counterbalance. Interestingly, though, I felt like there was, unfortunately, before our most recent president, but there did seem to be a real trajectory toward the states that do have it, you know, examining it and getting rid of it, mostly for practical reasons, because it was so expensive and because it was so legally fraught. In the United States, obviously, we put a moratorium on it for a while that the Supreme Court ended up lifting. At this point, it's hard for me to tell if there's any trajectory anymore. It seemed like there was a while where it was really looking like a lot of the states were going to just say, you know what, forget it. You know, we're better off just doing life in prison without parole. I mean, Colin, do you have any sense of what's happening with that?
My sense is that there are some states that had previously banned it that are now considering reinstating it. And there has been some difficulty in terms of states that have the death penalty with lethal injection. Some of the manufacturers of some of the drugs in the three drug protocol have gone out of business, and other drug manufacturers don't want their names associated with lethal injection. And so there was a thought that maybe that would lead to other states banning the death penalty. But what that's done is, for instance, in South Carolina, we've said, well, we don't have lethal injection drugs, so we're going to make electrocution the sole method of execution. And then that is currently being considered in the House and the Senate here in South Carolina. In, I think it was Oklahoma. Yeah, Oklahoma has just passed legislation that's going to have executions using nitrogen gas. And this is something that's never really been tested before. There are questions about dosage, whether it's going to be effective or not. But that could just be a complete disaster there in Oklahoma with using this nitrogen gas for executions. But yeah, John, my sense is, if anything, it's going to be states bringing back the death penalty as opposed to states banning it in the next few years.
Well, I wanted to also talk about some things that have been happening in the news lately, because we on this show have been following what's going on in Philadelphia with Larry Krasner, who recently won his election to be the new district attorney there. And I have to say, I didn't expect the amount of things that he has already done. Everybody expected him to be a reformer, I think. But he is just clearing the decks as far as I can see. I mean, apparently recently he obviously reinvigorated their conviction integrity unit, but he now has considered a sentencing integrity unit. So it's basically to reexamine whether the sentences of people are fair. Am I understanding that correctly, Colin?
Yeah, absolutely. It is looking at both disparities among people who committed the same crime in terms of their sentence, as well as whether people who might have been convicted back in the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s, were given sentences that no longer are thought to be proportionate to the crime they committed. And so, for instance, if Ronnie Long's case were in Philadelphia, you might have different takes. You might say, look, in this case, assuming he's guilty, if he were guilty in this case, breaking into a home and committing a sexual assault, maybe he should spend the rest of his life in prison. But a lot of people would say for that type of case, even though he was given two life sentences, this is something where 42 years later, he should have a chance at freedom. And so I think it's a great move by Krasner to look into this and say, we have different opinions on sentencing than we did decades ago, and we should reopen some of these old cases and see if we should commute some of these sentences.
And my understanding was Larry Krasner is actually going to publicize that list that we talked about a few addendums ago, which apparently there was a list of problematic officers that the DA had maintained in order to not have them testify in cases. But he, at the time, we were wondering, you know, ever since the fact that there was a list had surfaced, that, you know, what would he do with that? And my understanding is that they're going to determine the status of all of them and actually release the names of people whose status has been determined, which is, again, do any of you worry that he's doing this too fast?
No.
No.
I say it can't come fast enough
for Rabia.
It can't be fast enough. One thing I want to mention about the sentencing thing, though, and recently, I think it was this reported in the last day or so, there's a memo that he has issued as guidance to his prosecutors, in which he tells them that when you're asking, I mean, for future sentences, for future prosecutions, that when you're asking for a sentence, like, you actually have to, you have to justify it. So you have to tell the court that this is how much it's going to cost to incarcerate this person for this many years, and we're going to justify it. And he says in the memo, just remember, you know, if you're asking for this many years, like, how many teachers and police officers and other folks can be paid a salary based on, like, how much we're going to spend incarcerating this person. And I think that's, I mean, the whole basis of the memo is that we are going to do our best to get rid of mass incarceration. We're going to fight back mass incarceration. I think this is, it's revolutionary. I mean, he has set an entirely new standard as a district attorney. I think they're welcome changes. I think they are long, long, long overdue. And I think it's the kind of thing, like, you, when you talk about, there's a lot of other DAs out there who say, oh yeah, we're making reforms. The reforms are so incremental and tiny and painstakingly slow that I think this is the kind of, you know, complete 180 we need to see, especially in areas like Philadelphia, where it's been decades of, like, injustice.
Well, I have some listener questions that I'd love to get to, if you guys are up for it. Our first one is from Dee Dee Nicole, who says, the most recent episode refers to Ronnie Long's car as the Long family car. How were the police able to search it without the consent of the owner of record, Mr. Long's mother?
Yes, there's a doctrine known as apparent authority. And what that says is if a person is a user of a vehicle, and in this case, Ronnie Long has driven it to the police station, he has apparent authority to consent to that search, even though it is owned by his mother. And so that's the way, if in fact he gave consent here, that the police were allowed to search the vehicle.
We also got one from J.B. Smoove. I don't know that it's the same as the comedian, but cool screen name, though. Says, I'm a week behind, but maybe you can give me your own opinion. How much of the victim's false identification is based on their inability to wanting to revisit the actual assault itself? And I think that's a very good question, because we're asking people who've experienced a trauma to re-traumatize themselves in order to identify this person. One of the things, by the way, Connie, I admire so greatly in the show is your real consideration of not re-traumatizing the people whose story you're trying to tell. I think your sensitivity is remarkable there. But I do wonder, does that affect the quality of eyewitness testimony?
I'm sure it does, right? They talk about how trauma can actually impact your memory and impact the way that you remember things or recall traumatic events. There's been a lot of discussion about that here in Canada when we're talking about sexual assault, victims of sexual assault, and how they're often questioned by police even before any kind of criminal trial. There's one of my colleagues here in Canada is a reporter by the name of Robin Doolittle, and she did this incredible investigation last year where she looked at the number of cases, complaints made by people about allegations of sexual assault that were made to police that were considered unfounded, and how and why police forces decided not to pursue charges. And she talks about, you know, the role of trauma, the trauma that these survivors or the women who came forward experienced, and how that affects their testimony. I mean, I don't have any expertise in that in particular, but you can imagine that would have huge implications.
I'll just go for one more. Here's one. This one came from Tailfoot McWalshy, who says, Long was offered a plea with 7 years. Could you discuss how most cases never go to trial, overcharging / plea leveraging, and the practice of coercing pleas a la Bordenkircher v. Hayes, 434 U.S. 357, 1978, as distinguished from Blackledge v. Perry, 417 U.S. 21, 1974? I'm going to take this one, Colin. as you know, in Blackledge, they were talking about a can of Dr. Pepper, whereas in Bordenkircher, they were talking about Mr. Pibb, which, as you know, they're very different sodas, and that's why it's completely different and inapplicable. No, Colin, you got to answer that question for me.
That's actually a great analogy. I'm teaching this in class tomorrow, and I might use that Dr. Pepper, Mr. Pibb analogy. Blackledge versus Perry says, if a defendant exercises a legal right, he can't be punished by the prosecutor. That's known as vindictive prosecution. So imagine that Ronnie Long were just charged with rape, and there's a question here about whether he could be charged with burglary because we don't know whether he stole the money or not. Let's say Ronnie Long moved to transfer venue in this case to another jurisdiction, and the next day the prosecution responded by adding the burglary charge. That would be vindictive prosecution, and that would be improper and a constitutional violation. What Bordenkircher versus Hayes says, though, is if you're in the process of plea bargaining and the prosecution has made an offer to the defendant, they can exert all sorts of pressure on the defendant and tell them, if you don't accept this plea deal, we're going to increase the number of charges, the severity of charges, the sentence we're seeking. So you could imagine in this case that the prosecutor would say during plea bargaining, look, here's the deal we're offering you, and if you don't plead guilty, we're going to add additional charges. We're going to seek the death penalty instead of a life sentence, assuming it's not mandatory. And so that is the point that the person on Twitter is making, is outside the context of plea bargaining, vindictive prosecution presents prosecutors threatening additional charges. But once you're in plea bargaining, that's the vast majority of cases now, you can have all sorts of pressure, which of course greases the wheels on defendants saying, I'm going to go ahead and take this deal because I have a huge concern. If I go to trial, I could lose my life. I could lose the rest of my life to a prison cell.
So it's two versions of what seems like the same things, but there are important differences.
Yes. Dr. Pepper, okay. Mr. Pibb.
You got it.
I have to say, as a Canadian, I do not know what Mr. Pibb is.
Thank you for clearing that up. Mr. Pibb was for devotees of Dr. Pepper, like myself, Mr. Pibb was a just disgusting knockoff.
Coke Pepsi. I get it.
Yes.
It's kind of like a Tim Hortons Krispy Kreme type thing. We're doing an American Canadian type deal.
Okay.
Both disgusting and terrible, but okay.
No, I'm sorry. By the way, I do not mean to besmirch Mr. Pibb. My joke is it tastes almost exactly the same. It's ridiculous in my regard to differentiate between the two is silly. But at any rate,
the Twitter flash that you're going to get for
Chris, I know. And I deserve it. Now I'm just taking controversial stands just to rile them up. I'm trolling at this point. Well, I wanted to say thank you so much, Connie, for being here. And thank you so much for making Missing and Murdered. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And I recommend it to anybody looking for a new one to listen to on your morning dog walk. Yes, it's beautifully done. And thank you so much for being here, Connie.
Thank you so much for having me and for listening to the podcast. I know that it can be a really difficult story at times because you're talking about children and the trauma they experienced. But I also hope that people hear the incredible strength and resilience that all of Cleo's siblings have. And, you know, they're recounting things that happened to them as children and difficulties they went through. But I am in constant awe of their strength and just the compassion and just the incredible way in which they want to honor their sister and find the answers that any family deserves to have.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, Colin.
Thanks, John. Always appreciate talking to you.
Finally, as some of you may have seen on social media, the next inmate scheduled to be executed in this country is William T. Montgomery. His execution is scheduled for April 11th, but there's new evidence that calls his conviction into question. Here's Colin's interview with Montgomery's attorney and a call to listeners, especially those in Ohio, to contact Governor Kasich about staying his execution.
I'd like to thank John Ebker for joining me today. He's one of the attorneys for William T. Montgomery, who's scheduled to be executed in Ohio on April 11th. Now, Mr. Ebker, the state's theory in this case is that Montgomery killed roommates Deborah Ogle and Cynthia Tinscher in Toledo, Ohio on March 8th, 1996. And my understanding specifically is the state's theory is that he killed Ogle during a robbery and then killed Tinscher because she was a witness to that robbery. Is that basic understanding correct of the state's theory of the case?
Yeah, and specifically, the state's theory really came from the mouth of the co-defendant, Glover Hurd, who was with the girls on that evening. And Glover Hurd cut a deal with the state to avoid the death penalty and to avoid some child molestation charges that he was facing in 1986. And he gave some various versions to the state, but his fifth version said that... And he was very specific that Deborah Ogle was killed first and Cynthia Tinscher was killed second to cover up the Ogle murder. But what was very important to the state's case was this timeline and this order of Ogle being killed first and Tinscher being killed second on March 8th.
And am I correct that Montgomery and his death sentence with the execution scheduled for the 11th, that's based upon the conviction for the murder of Ogle, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And overall, we're not going to delve into every detail in this case. There are some facts that are favorable, some that are unfavorable, and I'd recommend that listeners read the parole board's recent clemency report if they want all those details. What I want to do in this interview is hone in on what I see as sort of the key issue at this point. And that is that 6 years after Montgomery was convicted, there was a public records request. And keeping in mind, again, that the state's theory is that Ogle was killed on March 8th, what did this request uncover?
Well, it really produced a lot of the police reports that were in the state's file that were never turned over at the time of trial in 1986. And the most important police report that was revealed when the state turned these over in 1992 was that on the evening of March 11th into the early morning hours of March 12th, there was a police report from an individual who went to reported that he went to high school with Deborah Ogle, and that they were with some friends, and they claimed that they saw Deborah Ogle alive and in a car in the late evening hours of March 11th, early morning hours of March 12th, that they saw her alive, and they reported that to the police. The police never turned that over to Mr. Montgomery's defense team. So at trial, they did not have that information. And, you know, we and Mr. Montgomery's attorneys all along have argued that that information was exculpatory because it would have undercut the state's timeline that Ms. Ogle was killed on March 8th.
And so then the defense team, initially in state court and then in federal court in a habeas petition, claims that this was a Brady violation, that the state failed to turn over this material exculpatory information. And unsuccessful in state court, what's the initial ruling then in federal district court?
Well, in federal court, Judge Solomon Oliver of the Northern District of Ohio granted the habeas relief, basically ordered a new trial, and found that there was a Brady violation for the failure to turn over these police reports. There were a number of other Brady claims items that weren't turned over, but it was on this specific ground, the failure to turn over this police report indicating Ogle had been seen alive. That was the basis for Judge Oliver to grant habeas relief and order a new trial.
And then that gets appealed by the state up to the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit and assigned initially to a three-judge panel. And what's their initial determination?
So the initial three-judge panel affirmed Judge Oliver's ruling and ordered a new trial for Montgomery. But upon getting that result, the state moved for an en banc review for the entire full Sixth Circuit court for all the judges of the Sixth Circuit to review the matter. And it was at that en banc review that by a split vote of 10-5, the majority of the Sixth Circuit judges reversed Judge Oliver and reinstated Mr. Montgomery's death sentence.
And that majority of the en banc Sixth Circuit says it was still improper, right, for the state not to turn this over, but simply that the evidence didn't rise to the level of materiality that's needed to grant a new trial.
That's absolutely right. No one disagreed about the whether or not the state should have turned the police report over. The real dispute was whether or not it would have made a difference at trial.
Right. And in terms of those witnesses who said that they saw Ogle on March 12th, it's important to note that there is some countervailing evidence that these witnesses made statements after there was news of Mr. Montgomery getting a new trial, right?
Absolutely. When Judge Oliver initially ordered a new trial, the witnesses who were the subject of the police report back in 1996, some of them came forward and they said 6 years later that, maybe it was they were unsure and it possibly could have been Deborah Ogle's sister, who was like a year or two older than Deborah. And that was who they were speculating. Maybe that's who they saw that night and that it wasn't Deborah Ogle that they saw alive. So, you know, we don't know exactly, what they saw. All we know is what they said in 1986 and then what they said later.
Right. And then what we do know is after the Sixth Circuit reinstates the conviction and the death sentence, the defense team contacts Independent Forensic Services, LLC, to get an expert pathology report. And again, for reordering ourselves to the timeline, the state claims that Montgomery kills Ogle on March 8th and then kills Tincher that same day because she's a witness to the murder. And this report is reporting on Ogle's body, which was found in the woods on March 12th. And what does the report say about the body's condition and whether it's consistent with a death on March 8th?
Well, and it was really interesting. So, and when you described that the defense team reached out to the forensic scientists, it was really, at the time, Mr. Montgomery and his mother. They, on their own, contacted these forensic scientists. They're originally from Europe, but they live and work in Colorado now. and they asked them to take a look at the case. And in talking to the scientists, they made it very clear to Mr. Montgomery and his family, they would look at it, but, you know, they weren't going to promise any certain result. They were, in their words, just going to seek the truth. And so the independent forensic scientists looked at it, and first of all, they noted on the autopsy, the initial autopsy report stated Ogle's death as March 12th, which was contrary to what the state's theory had been all along. But besides just the initial date of the death that was on the autopsy report, they looked at the condition of Miss Ogle's body, and she had been found in a wooded lot in Northwest Ohio in March of 1986. And what the forensic scientists noted was that she didn't have a pooling of her blood on the side where her body should have been laying for those 4 days. If she was laying there for 4 days, there should have been pooling of the blood on the side where she was laying down. And that really wasn't apparent. And also, they noted that there weren't any, you know, animal markings or bugs, things that you would expect to find for a dead body that's laying in the woods for a couple days. There was nothing that they felt was supportive of a body laying there for 4 days. So their opinion was that they couldn't state for certain when Miss Ogle was dead, but they certainly believed that her date of death was closer to March 12th when she was found than March 8th when the state had argued at trial.
Yeah, and this is an issue that we've covered on the podcast before, the pooling of the blood and the lividity. And right, my understanding in this case is that Ms. Ogle was found and that when they moved the body, the liver pattern shifted. And essentially the way it works is when a person's alive, their heart is pumping blood. And when the person passes away, the lividity, the blood seeping into the tissues becomes fixed after between 6 and 12 or 8 and 12 hours. And so the point here of the pathologist is to say this lividity was not fixed as of March 12th, which means she could not have been killed on March 8th, which was, of course, 4 days before. That's sort of the gist of the lividity issue?
That is correct.
Right. And so you have this pathology report, but the attorneys at the time don't present it to the court in a timely fashion, right?
Yeah, so the attorney that was representing Mr. Montgomery, and he had represented him for years. I mean, this case was pending for 30 years. And when the attorney got this report, he presented it to which was the normal procedure if you're seeking a new trial, to present it back to the original state trial court. But he waited, I think, over 9 months before he filed the motion for new trial. So the state, opposed the new trial for Montgomery, and when it went up on appeal, usually the hurdle for any criminal defendant in Ohio when you're seeking a new trial with new evidence is, well, you know, you have to prove that you were unavoidably prevented, is the phrase, but unavoidably prevented from timely discovering this new evidence sooner and bringing your motion for a new trial much sooner. Usually that's the hurdle for criminal defendants. Well, the appellate court in Ohio actually said that he was unavoidably prevented from discovering this matter sooner. And that was a huge moment for Mr. Montgomery that he overcame that hurdle. But the appellate court went on to say his attorneys waited too long to file the motion for new trial, and that was why they affirmed the trial court's denial of the motion for a new trial. You know, that was when we became involved in the case. We absolutely disagreed with the court's ruling. I don't believe that the 9-month delay, especially in the context of a 30-year-old case, was sufficient to deny someone a new trial. But that's what the state court did. So Mr. Montgomery was left with no new trial and an execution that was set that was rapidly approaching.
Right. And so no court at this point then has ruled on the substance of this pathology report.
That's absolutely correct. When, the six total federal judges ordered a new trial, it was only on the withheld police report. No federal court has had the opportunity to look at the new forensic report, and also the forensic report combined with the withheld Brady evidence, that both undercut the state's timeline theory.
Right. But that withheld evidence and the new pathology report was shown to an original juror from the case, from the trial of William T. Montgomery, Sidney Thomas, and they, I understand, have submitted an affidavit that says what?
That's right. So the jurors were common in capital litigation to contact the jurors while the case is pending to see if they still feel the person is guilty and should be executed. So Mr. Thomas was one of the jurors that were contacted way back in 1992, and he did express a little maybe confusion as to kind of the law for capital punishment, but he really didn't say much more then. Well, we contacted him in 2018 with the withheld evidence and the forensic evidence, and presented this to him, and we tried to do it as fairly as possible. And Mr. Thomas signed an affidavit saying he would not have voted for guilt, and he also would have, this information would have affected his decision, and he would not have voted for the death penalty, even if he would have voted for guilty in the first phase of the trial.
Right, and then that takes us to last week, where you filed a clemency petition with the state parole board, and they voted last week 6-4 in favor of the governor granting clemency in the case. And one of the reasons they make a recommendation, the language says, is a general matter, capital proceedings should reflect a level of procedural integrity commensurate to the gravity of the punishment at hand. And what they find is the state failed to turn over certain evidence. There are questions about the timeline. And therefore, their recommendation to Governor Kasich is to commute this sentence to life without parole. What are your thoughts on what the parole board did there?
Well, I'm glad you picked up on that paragraph from their recommendation, because I was very excited to see them write that in their recommendation. When I went down to the parole hearing, I had experience with them in the past. I was a former prosecutor and former assistant attorney general in Ohio, and I'd worked on capital cases. And, there were a lot, starting with a Brady violation, and there just seemed to be a whole host of questions and problems with this case that should, as I argued to the board, should make any citizen in the state of Ohio uncomfortable with an execution in this case. And I'll be honest, the questions even, there were more questions as we prepared for the clemency hearing. When we brought in the forensic scientist to testify at the hearing, they're a husband and wife team. And the woman, Selma Eichenboom, who wrote the initial forensic report regarding the body, her husband, is specialty is ballistics. And it's gruesome, but when you look at the photos from the victims' bodies, they're obviously gruesome, but they each have entrance bullet holes and bullet hole wounds to their head. And the state's theory always was that they were killed with a 38 Bursa, which is a small handgun, and it's a small bullet, and it just makes a single hole when for an entrance wound. But as we were in the days before the clemency hearing, as we were looking at the photos for Deborah Ogle, there's a wound on her head where it's a much more I hate to be descriptive, but explosive, like almost like a star opening, as opposed to just a circle. And he told us with scientific certainty, he's like, look, this a Bursa would not make that hole. There had to be a higher caliber gun, like a 38 revolver. Well, when you read the transcript, the co-defendant, who there's always been a cloud around him, he had access to a 38 revolver. So, my argument to the parole board was that, this case has had disagreement all along the way. You've got six federal judges saying that this person deserves a new trial. We have Brady violations. We have new forensic evidence. And now we have a juror who presented with this evidence saying he wouldn't have voted for guilt or the death penalty. And I was really glad that the parole board focused, the majority of the parole board focused on the procedural integrity that is just not, that doesn't exist in this case, and that was a reason to in their recommendation not have an execution.
And then two final questions. The first is, as I said, this execution is currently scheduled for April 11th. The parole board's recommendation goes to Governor Kasich. Is he obligated to follow that recommendation?
Oh, no, of course not. He, it's up to Governor Kasich. This is just a recommendation at this point. We're in a holding pattern waiting for the governor right now. And there's no set time frame as to when he has to issue his decision. So we're hoping that the governor does follow the recommendation of the majority of the parole board and grant executive clemency in this case.
And then as the last question, this is something where people might listen or look at the details of the case and think he's innocent or think he's guilty or think there's a question about guilt or innocence. Going back to the recommendation of the parole board, this is something, right, where Governor Kasich can simply decide, I'm going to commute this to life without parole. And so it's not that Montgomery would, at least based upon what Governor Kasich does, have any chance of being released. It's simply about saying there's enough questions in this case that we don't want this execution to proceed as scheduled.
That's absolutely true. Governor Kasich could, commute Montgomery's sentence and have him walk out the door, or he could commute his sentence to life without parole. And that's what the parole board has recommended. The parole board has recommended him commute to a sentence of life without parole. So Mr. Montgomery would not be walking out the door in that situation. But what he could do is, this would still allow him to still pursue avenues to seek a new trial. He can't do that if he's dead. And so by granting him life without parole, Mr. Montgomery could still pursue those legal remedies.
And that's another addendum for you. If you feel like checking out our website, undisclosed-podcast.com, please do. There is a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. I am donating all of my fees for this episode to the Healing Justice Group. Healing Justice is a 501c3 organization based in Washington, D.C. They're focused on recovery and healing for those harmed by wrongful convictions. And you can help them at their website, healingjusticeproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod. And send any questions, please, to hashtag UDAddendum. Going to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, came through once again this week, as well as Hannah McCarthy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Mithil Telhan, our project manager. Thank you so much for listening again this week. I swear my audio problems will get worked out. Or the people who make Skype will pay for it. At any rate, have a great week, and I will talk to you again soon.